What we wanted to do at that time is say, well, what can we do for normal users, people that are out on the internet, and what can we do? And we had this experience in these proxies, either forward proxies or reverse proxies. And we said, well, maybe a way to solve the problem on the internet is actually allow you to create identity proxies. How's that for an idea? We instead of you going out and it's, Paul with his personal email address and his mobile phone and his credit card and all that, why don't we allow you to create multiple personas, which we call pseudos. That's why we have an app called My Pseudo, and go out. And when you go out, we'll give you a different phone number, we'll give you a different email address, we'll allow you to create virtual credit cards, we'll even give you a different browser and do all of these things so that when you go out, it's very hard to track you between one persona and another and between those personas and you.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of MyCitadel.help, where we discuss your online life, how to keep it safe, secure, private. And today we've actually got an excellent guest who has been very active in this space. We've got Paul Ashley from Anonymy Labs based here in Australia. Gordon, this is someone you came across. And yeah, I just had a wonderful time talking to him.
Yeah, quick plug. I heard him on the Firewalls Don't Stop Dragons podcast, which I'll link to in the description of the show notes. Excellent podcast about privacy and security. Almost as good as our one, Faris. And yeah, I was just interested in these are a lot of things that we talk about all the time, like email masking, using different mobile phone numbers, password managers, blah, blah. And he's got a commercial venture called My Pseudo, which you may have heard of if you're in the US, similar to other products and services around the space. But yeah, extremely interesting, very knowledgeable. He knows his stuff. He's a PhD. And we appreciate having our very first guest on the show talking about best practices and stuff we talk about every single episode. So yeah, really appreciate him coming on and really great interview.
If you enjoyed this podcast, please subscribe, like, and share so we can find others like yourself.
Paul, thank you very much for joining us. We've been looking forward to this. I know Gordon has especially. There's quite a few things we're keen to talk to you about. For me personally, one thing I'm keen to pick your brain on is not many people go down the PhD academic route and then end up in the private sector. It's quite a small amount of people. So I was involved in academia. I was offered to do a PhD. It just was not for me at the time. So I'm very impressed that you did your PhD. I don't know how hard that is, but then you're no longer in academia. You're more in the corporate sector. Can you just tell us a little bit about that journey, please?
Yeah. So it goes way back into the 90s, unfortunately. But I did an undergraduate degree in kind of engineering, computer science. Went out as you typically do, and became a programmer. I was writing at the time C code on Linux systems. Did that for about 4 or 5 years, and then I got interested in security. So I wanted to do a PhD in information security. I actually had some colleagues that had done that, and I thought, yeah, that's not a bad thing to do, and really didn't know what I was getting myself into. So I signed up, and it was actually about 1994. To a PhD, and I was going to be the first one to do a PhD in network security. All the people, and this was at QUT, and all of the PhD students there were all cryptographers, all mathematicians, had all done maths degrees, masters in maths, and then gone and decided, can I do elliptic curve cryptography or something like that? All of that were all the PhDs there. And then I did come along and said, I'll do a network security one. I was like, okay. So that's what I did. And I actually focused on authorization, which sort of got me into the identity space, and I've kind of been in that space ever since. I worked on it for 4 years, graduated in 99, but this was that decision point between academia and industry is I then get an offer for the US, come over to the US and come work for a company. And the company was working, it was a startup, and I'm working in exactly the same area that I did my PhD in, kind of this authorization space. So yeah, before I graduated, I was in Texas working for a startup over there. And then from there, that startup got acquired by IBM. I worked in IBM for about 15 years doing a whole lot of different security products around privacy, security, identity, with really interesting names like Identity Manager, Access Manager, Privacy Manager, all these sort of things, as you'd expect. And then back in about 2013, I got approached to say, would you come and start this privacy company? We've got a real problem of privacy in the on the internet, and everyone knows it's getting worse. Why don't you come across and do that? So 2014, I jumped out and helped start Anonymy Labs. There's five of us on the Gold Coast in a room, and you know, I guess the rest is history. That's kind of the academic into industry journey.
So we're aware that we had a privacy issue in 2013, but that was, you know, 12 years ago, and it's not a problem now. Everything's gotten better.
Except everything's got a lot worse, and it seems to be getting worse all the time, and I think AI could actually be making that worse.
Yeah.
And I can tell you back then, yeah, it was bad. Even in 2013, 2014, it was bad. And so what we wanted to do at that time is say, well, what can we do for normal users, people that are out on the internet, and what can we do? And because we'd come from this enterprise security background, you know, I'd come from IBM and a bunch of other people had come from Bluecoat, Symantec, and those sort of companies. We had this experience in these proxies, either forward proxies or reverse proxies. And we said, well, maybe a way to solve the problem on the internet is actually allow you to create identity proxies. How's that for an idea? We, instead of you going out and it's, you know, Paul with his, you know, personal email address and his mobile phone and his credit card and all that, why don't we allow you to create multiple personas, which we call pseudos? That's why we have an app called My Pseudo, and go out. And when you go out, we'll give you a different phone number. We'll give you a different email address. We'll allow you to create virtual credit cards. We'll even give you a different browser and do all of these things so that when you go out, it's very hard to track you between one persona and another and between those personas and you. That was kind of the foundation of Anonymy back in 2014. And we started by just building mobile apps. So we built an app, one that was called Pseudo App. It was around communication. It was around that calling and encrypted messaging and everything for a pseudo. And then we had a Pseudo Pay. And eventually they got pushed together into an app called My Pseudo that has all of the functionality in there. But that was kind of the start of the company. And obviously we've gone a lot further since then. You know, as I said, we started with five on the Gold Coast. We've now got 55 developers on the Gold Coast and about 50 in the US. So we're about 110 people altogether now. And continuing solving this kind of security, privacy, identity-focused world.
Back then, you would have been way ahead of the curve. Was it difficult to get customers, clients, just to pitch to them, look, this is really important, your online life? I mean, now we're aware of it, but back then, was that a struggle?
Yeah, although in some ways we were fortunate. I mean, I don't know if it's fortunate because the privacy problem was getting more and more recognized as we went 2014, 2015, 2016. You know, they say to be a successful startup, you have to have a market. It's like people actually want this stuff. And kind of all the privacy issues out there were driving that market for us. Then you've got to have sort of good products as well, and then you've got to be able to get them out there. And we were ahead of the curve. So we've hit, in Anonymy, I think we've hit 22 patents that we've written over those last 11 years. And the reason we did that, right from the beginning, when we started to build this technology, we said, let's start to patent it because there was no other products out there that talked about personas, identities, and going out with multiple and doing all that. And that was really the foundation of the company. Everything we build, we have a platform, everything is based on this identity concept. That was pretty revolutionary. And those patents have served us well now because people are coming along now and saying, yeah, that multiple identity is really good. Because if you ever look at what traditional privacy or security privacy technology for people, it's kind of been, we'll give you an antivirus for your Windows box or Mac, we'll give you a VPN, maybe we'll get you a password manager, but we were the first to sort of take it up to the next level and say, well, how about we give you a different identity and let you go out to the internet with that? And that was, I think, kind of some of the foundations of the company.
Thanks for coming on, Paul. I have a million questions, but I'd actually, you guys are getting into the weeds way too quickly.
Okay, let's go up.
I'd like to zoom out a little bit because firstly, someone listening to this podcast hopefully is interested in privacy, but I guess an annoying question that we get all the time, well, two really, is one, why should I care? And two, maybe people do care, but the convenience of having Apple with iCloud or Google with Google Drive, it's sort of like, I do care about privacy, and I know this from asking my family and friends, I do care about privacy, but Apple, Google, Microsoft, whoever knows what I do anyway, so it's convenient, I'm not really going to bother. What do you, how do you kind of tackle that?
And that's say? always the difficulty actually with privacy companies. Like, how do you monetize it? Like, how do you, and you know, how do you get people to spend money and their own time on privacy? And that is a, that's a pretty hard problem to solve. And it is interesting because I always, when I talk to people and, you know, to quite a number of podcasts and different things, is I always say privacy is a journey. It's going to take you time to get there. You can't do it overnight. Why would you do it? Well, if you don't, then you're going to be a victim of all sorts of different things, identity theft, financial fraud. You know, you're the person who'll get that text message where you, because they know everything about you, they can pretend to be you and all those things. AI is, of course, making that worse because now they can, you know, they can fake your voice and video and all sorts of things. But I think the more of your personal data you have out there, the more really that you're at risk. And you see it all the time where it's either identity theft, financial fraud, my credit card's been stolen. I got a text message, I thought it was my daughter and it was actually the scammer and I just paid the money. And, you know, we're seeing it every day, right? So I think that living in a more private, protecting way for yourself helps defend against that onslaught that's happening around the world of everybody coming to you with, you know, how many fake emails do we get? How many text messages and all those things? And the more they know about you, the more easy it is for them to, you know, kind of be able to exploit you.
Absolutely. And you sort of touched on that sort of security and privacy being intertwined, being similar but separate. And yep. I'd like to get into MySudo in a minute. So people are interested in this, listening about privacy. How do they get started? Like, getting into MySudo in a minute, but what's sort of the low-hanging fruit that someone maybe feels overwhelmed, they're tied to Google or Apple? What are some easy steps or first steps that someone can kind of do?
Yeah, and I think, you know, and I was kind of bagging at some of the base technology before, but really where you need to start is just things like a VPN. Like, have you got a VPN on your mobile devices? Have you got it at home? Do you connect from home out to the internet with a VPN? I think that's a place to start, because obviously being able to track your IP addresses at home and your telco providers knowing what you're doing is not great for privacy. So I always say you do need these base ones. And then I would say a password manager is really useful as well, because you need to be able to have many accounts with different passwords and be able to manage two-factor and all those things. And it can get a bit annoying actually, but you need to be able to protect that way. And then it's after you've got through that, then it's like, okay, now let's start not using your personal data everywhere. Don't use your Google Mail everywhere. And that's why we go through and say, look, we'll create you an email address, start to use that in this scenario. And it's either will it last a short time or will it last a long time? That depends on the use case. And then what about a different phone number? Don't put your mobile phone number everywhere. Put something else out there. So I think there is this logical journey. And I say for most people, it probably takes a year to go from a very kind of, let's say, unprivate state to something that's better. And you can't solve every problem. Like, I use an iPhone, and I know that Apple is watching everything that I'm doing, but it still doesn't stop me with my 200 accounts that I have out there. We all have 200 to 300 accounts out there, to be able to use different, you know, identity information on those accounts, to, you know, use the right sort of passwords and do all that, and don't use my credit card out there and all those sort of things. That, even though, you know, I say, well, they can just follow you on that. Okay, so Apple does know a lot about what I'm doing, but I'm still careful even the way I set up my iPhone. But there's still a lot of other things you can do when you're going out to all these different sites that you're going to need to use.
I'm sorry to say, Paul, you've lost some credibility. Only 200 accounts? I think
300? I don't know.
Yeah, I think my password manager's got a lot more than that. But yeah. Totally get it. And absolutely, what we've been talking about, a journey, it's a sliding scale. Like, you don't have to throw the baby out with the bathwater. I'm a unique case in that I go to the complete extreme. I don't have Google or Apple accounts or lots of stuff, but I realize that I'm abnormal. That's not the normal use case. So someone stick with their iPhone or Apple, or if they're in the Google ecosystem, you could do some really simple stuff. Start using a password manager, get away from Gmail and get a proper private email address. I mean, just those two things alone, you can kind of do for free or next for free. Start using a VPN and sort of go down that progression of, you can't solve everything in one day. As you said, it might take a year, it might take 2 years. So
yeah, correct. Yeah,
yeah, that's, so. That's, yeah, sorry.
I think it's like I always think of it as like going to the gym. Like when you go to the gym, you know, in the beginning you're pretty terrible, and over time you get better and better because you kind of build those muscles. And I always look at it as you've got to build up a privacy muscle, and it does take time to do that. And, you know, you get better and better at it. You know, when I first started using my pseudo and trying to use these different accounts, I made mistakes all the time, right? I wasn't used to it. I'd go and create an account and go, oh, no, I just put my personal email address there. I just gave that person my mobile phone. But over time, as you build a privacy muscle, you sort of get a little bit better at it. And so when someone asks you an email address, you don't give them your personal email address. You give them some, you know, other one. You give them a different phone number than what's your mobile, and you just start to get into these better habits, and you're always checking like my VPNs are on, or I've got them set so that I can't connect unless I got it on. So over time, you sort of, I think you get better and better, and the muscle gets better and better.
With that, Paul, so like last week I was at my Pilates studio, the instructor walked up to me and said, happy birthday. And I just stared at her like, what the hell are you talking about? And she said, it's your birthday today. I'm like, all right. I said, no, you don't have my real birthday. You don't even have my real last name. The only thing they have that's real of mine, and we've talked about this on the show before, we show people how to use Fastmail, Mast, email. The only thing they do have is my actual phone number, because I've not found a way around that where I can just do like a Mast phone number. But from my understanding, that's something that Pseudo does provide. Can you explain that?
Yeah, and to be honest, it's we're very, very focused on the US. I mean, when right from the time that Anonymy started, we're very, very focused on the US market because it's such a big market, and trying to get everything right there first. And so what you can do is we will actually issue only three types of numbers at the moment: US numbers, Canadian numbers, and UK numbers. But what you can essentially do, and you could issue yourself a US number, but the idea is each of your pseudos, you can have up to nine of these pseudos or nine personas, each one can have a phone number. And that phone number is a full kind of mobile working number, so you can text with it, you can call with it, people can call in, they can text you. And it's very useful to be able to have one of those. So, you know, just simple use cases. You know, if we have a look at, you know, somebody's at home, they say, okay, I need to get a plumber around, right? What do I get? How do I call them? What details do I give them? Why don't I give them a pseudo email address and a pseudo phone number? And sometimes you say, oh, I still want to give them my name. I'm okay with that. I just don't want them to be able to connect to me on all my personal information, on my personal email and phone number and things like that. So the idea is for these different use cases, and shopping's another one. That's why we have virtual credit cards. In virtual credit cards, that say, well, when you sign up, use a pseudo email address, pseudo phone number, and don't give them your real credit card, the plastic one that sits in your wallet. We let them create virtual credit cards and then spend with that. And so, again, it's just this continual layer of protection for a person so that I can still go to some unknown website and buy this part for my bike, but I'm not giving all this information that they're bound to lose or sell on you anyway. So we just look at it from a use case point of view. What are all the things that people want to do, and where do they need to get protection?
We've looked at email masking. I think a lot of people sort of understand that, but maybe you could just go through that again. But what you explained makes perfect sense, but could you just perhaps explain it to someone who isn't familiar with email masking or, you know, virtual credit cards, all that kind of stuff?
And there actually is different types of privacy protection. Sometimes they're just sort of forwarders. So they'll let you create some sort of email address and various variations on that. But what's really happening is when the email comes in, they're just forwarding it off to, say, your Gmail address, and you go and look at everything in Gmail. That's one method of doing it. And we actually looked at that, but we kind of didn't like that method so much. So we actually went for the approach of, let's create real inboxes. So when you get a pseudo mail email address, it's not like a proxy or something to some other email. You're actually using that as your email inbox, and you can send from there and do all the normal things you can do with email. So our approach was to create real email addresses, and it's the same with our phone numbers too. So there's other privacy companies out there that kind of proxy it. So the proxy from a phone number to your mobile and back and stuff like that. We actually don't do that. We generate a full phone number that you can use within the app, and that can take incoming calls. You can do outgoing calls. It does SMS both directions, all those kind of things. So we've gone kind of for a slightly different method to some privacy protecting tools, in that we've gone for sort of real email addresses, real phone numbers, and the virtual credit cards. You know, you've got the date, the CVC, the number, and all those things you need to buy something online.
Quick question about that, and this is slightly related, but I've actually had problems in the past using different services. with sending, like, you know, your bank or you're traveling overseas or whatever, them sending that to like a virtual phone number, like they didn't like that and it didn't sort of work. Is that still an issue or?
It depends on the situation. So that it was more of an issue, I would say, because we've been doing this for 10 years. And I would say when we first started, we used to have that problem with email addresses. They wouldn't accept them and phone numbers. But I think that's sort of getting rarer and rarer. Our phone numbers are VoIP numbers, right? And so if you have a provider that does a detailed search to see if it's a VoIP number and blocks that, then they'll just say, sorry, we won't accept that number. And sometimes that does happen. But I think, I probably think that 95% of the time it's just fine, and it works well. But there are certain providers, and same with our pseudo mail address. Like I use it, I probably over 200 of my accounts have got a pseudo mail email address in there. But if I go to Discord, it won't accept pseudo mail email addresses, and that's because on some service that they're using, they somehow blocked that pseudomail.com domain. Why, I don't know, but that's the only one that I can think of where I can't use a pseudomail.com domain is on Discord. Why, I don't know, and I try it maybe every few months. I see if I can change my email address and it still won't let me, but I suspect in time that whatever that service is, our email domain will drop off that and we'll be okay, because I've noticed over time that both the VoIP numbers and the email addresses have got better and better being accepted.
Paul, just with a lot of countries moving into or making the move into digital IDs, central bank digital currencies, what is the concern for people now? Because we saw like this was, you use the word, a test bog with the Aadhaar system in India, where they launched it in 2016, 2017, and you've since had 800 million people's data basically leaked onto the dark web up for sale. So we're looking now, there's a big push in G20 countries to move everything online. With what the services that you're providing, A, is it better that they sign up before this is fully implemented? Is it going to be harder once a digital ID comes in? And does it not matter because, A, it's the government, they're going to leak your details involuntarily?
Yeah, and actually it introduces a whole new topic, which I don't know if you want me to talk about decentralized identity, but if you have a look at identity systems around the world, and Australia's got one of those, the MyGov system, which they're kind of renaming and refashioning at the moment. But these are using what's called federated identity management, right? I'll explain the different types of identity management. So if you go up to a website and enter a username, password, and you're logging onto that, we call that centralized, right? That's centralized. And if you go back to the 90s, that's all there was sort of centralized. If you go into the 2000s, they started to introduce this technology called federated identity management, and we know it as social login or login with Facebook and login with Google and all that. And you hear protocols like OpenID Connect and SAML. When we got into that second phase, right, this is what, say, the Australian government's using and others, where if you go and have a look when you log into MyGov, you'll see SAML up there and all that. It's still a pretty much a centralized system. Like you're putting all your data there. If somebody breaks in, they can get all the data of all the people, right? And so they're the kind of the identity provider, and then the service providers are each of the departments. If you have a look at a new technology that's been around for about 8 years now called decentralized identity, this actually fixes a lot of the problems. And strangely, EU is going down this path, which is a much more modern path. So how does that work? So in the EU, every citizen within about a year or two will have an identity wallet, right? You'll have an identity wallet that you'll have on your mobile device. That identity wallet is supposed to hold credentials about you. So it could hold your driver's license, it could hold your passport, it could hold your gym membership and all these different things, right? And the reason I'm telling this story is that's the right way of doing identity management, say at the government level. The way we're doing it in Australia is a much older, kind of old-fashioned way of doing it, or this kind of centralized, federated approach. The advantage of the decentralized approach is you just get issued, say, a driver's license, and we're actually seeing this, like in Queensland, there's a mobile driver's license, and it follows this ISO standard called MDL. And the advantage of that is it supports things like selective disclosure. So you can go up to a bar and they can say, look, I need to prove you're over 18. And you can prove that you're over 18 without giving all the other information on your driver's license. So, you know, driver's license might have 20 fields in it. If you show someone at a bar, your physical one, they can have a skim and have a look at your home address and whether you wear glasses and what you can drive and all that. But really, all they really want to prove is that you're over 18. And their Queensland driver's license is an MDL and is an example of decentralized identity. That's actually an identity wallet. It only has one what's called a verifiable credential in there, but it kind of gives you the hint of what you can do with those verifiable credentials. You can prove I'm over 18. So you can go online with MDL and prove to, say, a liquor store online that you're over 18, and then you can buy stuff. And you don't have to give away your name. You don't have to give away your birthday. You don't have to give away your home address and all that. So I think the way that the European Union is looking at identity, with people having identity wallets, being issued credentials into the wallet and being able to control both through what's called selective disclosure, which is if you've got 20 fields in there, I only show you three of them, and what's another one's called zero knowledge proof, where it says I can prove I'm over 18, but I'm not even going to give you my birthday. So there is a lot more privacy focused ways of doing identity management, say at the government or kind of country level, that's much better than what we're doing at the moment. So I guess that's a very long answer to say the problem is with these identity systems around the world is most of them are or that centralized style and very much open to abuse, right? But I think there's technology that should be replacing those. So if you're in the Australian government now, you should be going, we're going to do decentralized identity, we're all going to have wallets, we're going to have credentials in there, and then the user gets to decide what they present out of any of those credentials.
I think you've just described zero knowledge proofs.
Yes, I have. Yeah, that's just one. Zero knowledge proof is just one aspect of what we call verifiable credentials.
But let's be honest, I'm not surprised that governments like the Australian government want to go down this centralized system. And in the past, 3 or 4 years ago, they were talking about a blockchain-based system. And I was kind of mildly interested. Oh, that kind of sounds interesting if it was distributed and decentralized. But it's like, not really. They're going to be the only ones actually mining it and having the node for it. So it's kind of like a centralized blockchain, which just sounds like an absolute mess. But anyway.
Yeah. And so there is technology. Whether they decide to use it is another thing. I don't know what's being talked about in terms of updating the MyGov or the, what is it called, MyID now, and what's happening there. But at the moment, I'd say the system is pretty fragile in that they've got a centralized database that you log into and it's got all the information there. And, you know, we know what happens when you build a system like that.
So going back to Faris's question then, assuming we're going to have a federal system in Australia or whatever country that is going to be centralized, what can we do about it? Assuming that eventually the data is going to be leaked and hacked and something's going to go bad.
Yeah, I guess that there's one aspect of it is again, don't give them your personal data when you're signing up. Try to give them different email address, phone numbers and things like that. But in the end, I mean, if you think about the Australian government and your record on there, you know, it's going to have all sorts of information about you on there. And even to the case where, you know how it works, you go on there and it says, like, I want to link it to ATO, I want to link it to this department. So all of that information is sitting there. So I think it's fundamentally a centralized system, and there's a little bits that you can do, but in the end, there may not be that much you can do, except if they redesign it like the EU is doing. So EU is kind of doing theirs from scratch, and they've said we're going through this decentralized. Under it, it's got a blockchain called EBSI, and they're going for a much more decentralized approach, which is you go and get a credential, and then you decide where you want to present it. And you can use it to log into sites, you can do all sorts of different things, but it's a much more decentralized approach in that the user's holding their identity data. It's not all being stored up in this central database.
So at the very least, and I know that sounds sort of dark and depressing, but at the very least, we can give a unique email address, unique credit card, unique password, unique mobile phone, even if we're dealing with these centralized systems. So at the very least, we can at least do that.
Yeah. Because it's no different to, you know, if you log on to a website to go and buy, it might be a bicycle website and you want to buy some parts on there. It is a centralized, you give them a username, password, they'll ask for some personal data and that. And that's when you give them alternate data at that point. Because you can't stop if they sell your information or get it stolen. You can't, there's nothing you can do about that. Well, that's why our approach is to have this persona approach, because at least if it gets sold or stolen, they're selling your persona information, which you can just reset and, you know, every year if you want to create a new one. So it's sort of garbage data in some ways.
So I'm going to play devil's advocate for a second. We could, for example, get our own VPN, get our own secure end-to-end encrypted messaging system, virtual credit cards, mobile phone numbers, blah, 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 from all these different products and services. You are offering sort of that sort of, I don't know if you offer all of those things. Do you offer virtual credit cards as well?
Yeah, we offer all those things. So if you go into the MySudo app, everything you just talked about, so there's end-to-end encrypted messaging in it, end-to-end encrypted video and voice. So it's got that, like if we've both got MySudo, we can do end-to-end encrypted voice, video, messaging, and email. If you're going outside of it, right, so I want to use MySudo with my dentist, that's when you've got to have a phone number and everything is in the clear. So when you're SMSing someone, the protocol just says it's in the clear. So you can't do much about that, but you can still be dealing with a phone number that's not your mobile phone number. And do we do virtual cards? We do that. So we actually do quite a lot. The way we approach this is we build a platform, and in that platform we have, you know, virtual credit cards. We have telephony, which is the phone number support. We actually have VPN. We actually have password management. We have a whole lot of these different services. And you look at MySudo is kind of pulling a whole bunch of those services together into an app. But we also, in Anonymy, sell into enterprises and build apps for them, and they might use some different combination of services that we have. So the way that the company's kind of has evolved over time is we look at the company as a platform of security and privacy services, which you mix and match together depending on the use case that you're trying to solve.
So...
Sorry, let me jump in.
Sorry.
just on that. So, but yeah, I did have a look at the Sudo app. So with that, just, and I have to ask a question because we are privacy and digital sovereignty podcast. Does Anonymous have access to users' data and information? Is that something people in Anonymous can see?
No. So one of the things that we did right from the beginning is to say, we don't want to know who our users are. Right. And there's one exception to that, but let's say in general, say you download MySudo and you'll notice, oh, I never signed up. Right? I can do email, I can do messaging and all these things. And Anonymous got no information on me. In fact, we don't know who any of our users are. The one exception is if you use virtual cards, because of regulations, we have to go through an identity verification. But even in that case, we use a third-party provider, you go through identity verification, and then we've got the information for a certain amount of time. But the idea there is that's the only use case where regulation forces us to collect personal information of a user. In all other cases, we don't. And you have a look, we have a VPN product, and with that VPN product, again, it never asks you for any personal information, right? So our idea is that we don't want to know anything about the user. All the end-to-end encrypted stuff, obviously, we can't get in because it's you know, the keys are on each of the mobile devices. That's the other thing that we do is all of the encryption keys are all stored out on the user's devices. So on your MySudo devices, you have a whole bunch of these different keys, you know, different keys for each sudo. And the idea is from the back end, there's very little what we can see about your communication. We, you know, try to limit it as much as possible. And so if an SMS comes in from your dentist to say you've got an appointment tomorrow, the minute it enters the MySudo back-end system, it gets encrypted with your public key that where you've got the private key on your phone. So it gets stored, encrypted. Your phone then can go and pick it up and decrypt it so you can see it. But if you look at our back end, everything is encrypted in the back end where the decryption keys are actually out with the user. So we put a lot of thought into how we've designed this. We have a platform, Secure Comms, to do all that end-to-end encrypted voice, video, messaging, and all that kind of stuff. Yeah.
No, thank you. No, it makes a lot of sense. Yeah, I appreciate you answering the question. And that's, not many, I can't think of any other company that would have to approach it that way. So it definitely has the end user's privacy in mind.
Yeah, and you, the way I guess you can see that, if you go and have a look for any security or privacy incidents for Anonymous, we've been going 11 years, you won't find any, right? We don't have any. And then the next obvious question, which you haven't asked, but most people ask is, surely if you're creating pseudos, that's gonna attract all the criminals in, right? And so will people use MySudo for kind of criminal ventures and stuff? And the answer is No, we find that doesn't happen very often. So we do get contacted by law enforcement, but it's pretty irregular. And I think the reason for that is behind the scenes, like if you're going to get phone numbers and virtual cards, you have to have a subscription with MySudo. So you had to go through either Apple or Google to do that. And we're talking about doing outside of those systems at the moment. But I think the advantage of those systems is it doesn't matter what you do. Apple will know who you are and Google will know who you are. It doesn't matter what you try to do to protect that. I think it's almost impossible not to disclose who you are. So I think the reason why people don't use MySudo, for example, for criminal things is at the end of the day, what happens if law enforcement comes to us, we go, we don't know anything. But you can go to Apple or you can go to Google if you want and they'll probably tell you something. But we don't know anything. We've got nothing in our systems that identify people. But they can always go to Apple, Google. And I think the fact that is a reality of the world, stops people using our app for sort of criminal engagements.
And is that the only access that like Apple or Google Store would have? They can just see that they've downloaded MySudo. They don't have access to any of the text, any of the content within the app, or do they?
No, they have no access to any of that. What they do have is they know that if you take the iOS example, you've gone to the App Store, you've downloaded it, and they'll also know when you've taken a subscription. And that's the point where, you know, you do payment for the subscription, because we work on a subscription model of, you know, monthly or yearly subscriptions, and then there's kind of three different levels. And so that's what they know about you. They know this phone has installed it, and they know that maybe it's taken these subscriptions, but they can't get access to any of that. Messages or anything. Yeah, it's impossible.
So where do you see the future with privacy? Because I'm seeing all the time ads like Optus and all these people, yep, we were hacked, but it's different. And they're not saying they're doing anything different, just like you said before. It's just a rebrand.
Yeah, I can remember the Optus exposure. It wasn't that long ago. It was only like a year or two ago, where they lost, was it something like 7 million accounts that had every bit of information about them. And I actually looked at that I actually felt a bit sorry for Optus, because the reason they had that data is they, in Australia, when you get a phone number, a mobile phone number, government law says you have to have identity verification. So they went through the identity verification. What they should have done is 3 seconds after the identity verification is thrown all that data away and just marked your account as being identity verified. But the government actually has a second regulation, which is you must hold the data for 7 years. So, you know, Optus is in a position to not only be forced to collect that private data, but then they're forced to hold on to it, which is really the problem. So, wouldn't it be much better? In fact, this is what really should happen now. And I said, this is where decentralized identity comes in. You go to get a new phone and the government says you have to be identity verified. Well, what you should be able to do is present your MDL. You've got the driver's license there. Just be able to present that you've got a valid driver's license. That should be the end of the story. They shouldn't store any information from you. The fact that you've got a valid driver's license should be enough to get you a phone number. And so there should be no new identity verification. They shouldn't be accessing any new personal data. They should be able to use something like the driver's license just to say, present that you've got one. Okay, we know you've got one. We're done. Right? That's what should really happen these days. Don't collect the personal information. Don't ask for identity verification, because all you're doing is exposing your organization to a lot of risk.
Yeah, I have to admit, I'm very, very nervous and apprehensive about us moving digital, because I had a situation about a year ago. I was selling a property, and I had to go to the post office to confirm my identity. And I had birth certificates, passports, driver's license. I had 10 documents. The one thing I didn't have was a Medicare card, because I hadn't been living in Australia for several years. Mm. So I'm standing in front of this person with a history of 10 official documents. And she's literally looking at me and says, computer says no.
Because you didn't have that one piece of
identity. I didn't have the one Medicare card. Yep. And I'm like, it was insane. Like, it was like an episode of Little Britain. Computer says no. So fact that you have a person standing in front of you who has all these IDs and birth certificates, and this person is just basically saying, there's nothing I can do. Computer says no.
And it is crazy. And this is why I actually do like the EU approach, because what you should have been able to do is maybe you had on your phone, your driver's license or your passport, electronic versions, and you should be able to go, look, I've got it here. I can prove that I've got one. You don't need to know anything else about me. You can just go ahead and replace my passport, say, whatever the situation was that you needed all that for. And so I think there is approaches that make it much better, but you've also got to get take up with these government bodies to go down this path. And this is why, because I you know, I'll be back in Europe in sort of middle of the year, you know, presenting at conferences there. But the approach that they've taken is much more a privacy-centric approach, where the data is with the user, you minimally have to disclose it. Just the fact that you've got on there a passport might be enough to say that's identity verification done. There's a lot of advantages once we go down this model. I was actually pretty pleased to see the Queensland government go down this ISO standard MDL driver's license, because that's the foundation. As I said, even if you go into that Queensland driver's license app and it says, you know, prove that I'm over age, you know, over 18, other cases it might give my full identity. So, for example, if you get stopped by a police officer, you can present it to them instead of your plastic one, and you might in that case have to show everything. But you get those choices, and I think that's, those are the foundations for privacy, is where I only have to give the minimal information for the situation that I'm in.
Yeah, we could do an entire episode on zero knowledge proofs, and I find them absolutely fascinating.
Yeah.
Because it really is this concept, and I think things are slightly changing. You know, companies and governments are sort of starting to realize that the less we keep about personal information about people, the less we have to protect, the less we're going to leak. But then again, as you said with the Optus hack, it was, you know, you can blame Optus, and they'll certainly default at some extent, but they're required to keep a lot of this stuff. So, you know, why is there government regulations that you have to require driver's license and all this kind of ID stuff in their database? As you said, as soon as someone's approved, there should be a checkbox or a field in the database, approved, yes, no. You don't need to keep driver's license, and it's just insane. It drives me insane.
Some of it's just historical, I think, because if I look at the US, you can go to the US and get a mobile phone number and you don't have to provide any identity, right?
Yep.
Here, you have to do identity verification to get your mobile phone number and your SIM card or whatever. So that's kind of the starting point of the problem. And then you've got all the follow-on, like, well, once they've done the identity verification, all that personal data they've got to keep. And so it's kind of it's sort of a failing method. I think there's much better ways in the future that we can go to stop doing some of these things.
So for someone like me, Paul, and I'm the 0.0001% of society.
You're the tinfoil hat.
I use Linux, so I don't have a Google or Apple account or whatever. And I use Graphene OS on purpose because I don't have a Google account or whatever. Can I still use my sudo if I don't use the virtual cards? Is that the case?
Yeah, you can. So we actually have a build we do. Every time we do an Android release, we actually do a release for Graphene OS. Right, for that exact reason, there's a number of people who want to use Graphene OS, and they don't want to link the apps on that device to a Google account. So I tell you, the way they do it is they go and create either an Apple or Google account, and they create a MySudo instance on there, and then they get their Graphene OS and they install MySudo on there, and then you can move your MySudo account across from one device to other. So on this device that you're using MySudo on every day, you actually have no link back to a Google account there. So people do get around it, and we do have a lot of users on Graphene OS. I think they just download the APK off our website, install that. But they do have to have a MySudo account, especially if you're doing things like virtual cards or even phone numbers. Yeah, you've got to have a subscription. So you've got to have a subscription somewhere. But once you've got that, and so people have this second device they have a subscription on, and then they just move the MySudo account across to their Graphene OS device. I don't know if that any of that made sense, but there are people that...
No, it kind of doesn't. And the sticking point, I guess, is for Graphene OS is the Google Pay. So you initially need some sort of temporary Google Pay account that you can then sort of initialize everything.
Yeah, and but I think you can do it. Yeah, it depends on how far you go, but what most people do in them, if they want to use Graphene with MySudo, is, as I said, they'll have a second device that's either onto the App Store or Play Store. They'll get the MySudo subscription and be paying it, and then they'll just move that account, because you're in the MySudo, you can move from device to, we do multi-device, you can move from device to device, and then on the Graphene OS account, they've moved their MySudo keys and things, and they can access it, but it's not the one that has the Play Store or the Play Store or App Store account.
Gotcha. That's a lot better, actually. Yeah.
Gordon put me on the Graphene, so, and I'm keen to get a pseudo. So I actually might do a how-to video on that one, Paul. I think that's a good idea.
Yeah, and all of this stuff, we have a pretty extensive knowledge base that we've built up over the years. And all of that, if you go and have a look at the MySudo knowledge base, all of that's explained about what to do. And you, and on there, you'll see the APK. And so every time we probably release a new MySudo version on Apple and Google, probably every 6 weeks. And part of that process, we then put the APK up with the latest build on there.
So, Paul, let me ask you an annoying question that I already know the answer to, but I have to ask it to do the other side of the argument.
Mm.
If we use MySudo, are we just centralizing all our trust in you guys? Whereas if we use separate servers for a VPN, for email, that at least if one of them gets compromised, it's only that. So what's your argument?
You could argue that, you know, when you've got MySudo and you're doing all your encrypted messaging with us, you're doing your encrypted videos. Like, I'll give you an example. My brother lives in Sydney, and every week we both boot up MySudo and do encrypted video to each other. Right? And so, as I said, we do all these different capabilities. So you could argue, but I guess what we've done since we started the company has been, you know, it built it in a very, very privacy-sensitive way. You know, I've talked about how the back end's built. We've got nothing in there that's not encrypted. We really try not to store any information or even collect any information from our user base, et cetera. So I guess, how is trust built? Well, trust is built over time. And what we're hoping is over 11 years of having done this, if you go and have a look at, have we disclosed any information to anyone? Have we ever been hacked with private information or anything like that? You won't find any of that after 11 years. So I guess all I can say to you is that hopefully of running these sort of applications for this long that we've kind of built up some credibility in the privacy space that we are looking after our users and we're not storing data and we're not giving anything away. So it's even, as I said, like if law enforcement came tomorrow and said, look, I need the information, like, we just don't have it. That's normally our answer. We have no information. Whose number is this? We don't know. So we've gone for a real minimal model of having as least information as we can and encrypting everything. If something comes in the clear, like someone sends a Google email into a pseudo mail, as soon as it comes in, we encrypt it with the user's public key, and so only they can decrypt it from that point on. So I've put a lot of effort into that.
Yeah. And it's an annoying question because, of course, it's built on reputation. And so
it is built on reputation. And the only reputation I can say is go and have a look for any incidents related to the anonymity back end. I mean, we have a lot of users on the MySudo system, but you're not going to find anywhere out there any time that we've disclosed any information, personal information about any of our users. You just won't find it.
So just going back to the mobile phone thing, because for me, that's been a real sticking point. Like, I've used a couple of other services. I've used privacy.com and a couple of other things, and I travel a lot, but now that I'm in Australia, am I able to get, I wasn't clear about it, because I think you said US, UK and Canada at the moment.
One of the limitations is that we don't issue Australian phone numbers and you can't use virtual cards in Australia. So I said most of our users, if I was to go through our user base, probably 80% are in the US, 10% in Canada and 10% in the UK. They're kind of the markets that we're focused on. And it's not to say that we're not going to go more global, but we've really tried to focus on building the app. So we've got mobile apps, we've got browser extensions for 4 different browsers, plus we also have MySudo Desktop now. So you can install a MySudo Desktop and use that for your email, and you're going to be able to do all of your SMSs and your voice calling and all that from that as well. So we're trying to build the base platform before we go sort of global with it. And the issues with global is not that it's any hard technically. The issues are around regulation. So I said, like in the US, we can issue a VoIP number, don't have to do anything. In Australia, if we want to issue you a VoIP number, we have to go through identity verification and store that information and do all those things that Optus had to do. So every country is different in terms of regulations around both phone numbers and virtual credit cards.
So with that limitation, if I wanted to get started with a virtual number, obviously I can't get an Australian one, I could still get a US one.
You can get a US one. Yep. You certainly can.
And could I use like something like, not Google Voice, but something like that with that as well? Or how would that work?
And we have actually quite a lot of people in Australia who get US numbers, more because they're dealing with, you know, they want to have a local number that's a local US number. The big advantage of our numbers in general is – it doesn't matter where you are in the world. If somebody calls that number, it's going to land on your MySudo device, right? So you can, the reason why quite a few Australians have US numbers, maybe they like me and work with a company that's kind of across the US, but they can, I can give a phone number out to someone in the US. It's a local number for there, and it ends up, you know, answering it on my pseudo phone, and I'm sitting in Australia at the time. They'd have no idea that's happening. But at the moment, we're, as I said, like we have been very focused on US, Canada, and the UK.
So what do you give to local Australian products and services when you need to give a number?
Oh, I actually do have Australian VoIP numbers. VoIP numbers. Yeah, I do have them. So it's part of testing here too, that I have actually VoIP numbers, Australian VoIP numbers, and they actually work. They're fantastic. I can use them just about everywhere. They are really great.
Excellent.
So with the virtual cards, there's no potential on the horizon for that arriving in Australia. So I don't see them.
I think we'll get phone numbers first and then virtual cards second. I tell you what happens with virtual cards is you have to actually work with an issuing bank. So we don't generate them. We work with an issuing bank, and they issue those virtual. And they are just – the only reason they're called virtual credit card numbers because there's no equivalent plastic card. They're just – but they're exactly the same as a credit card. And again, the point of those, and we actually have a lot of use of those, is that you can go to any website, and if you want to buy something, you use the virtual credit card, that number, and all the other pseudo details. And so if anything happens, it sort of doesn't matter, because you can just go, I want to use this once off, or I just want to have a limit on it. So you can put controls around it that you can't put with your plastic card.
That makes sense. I'm going to change topic to a rabbit hole, Faris, so feel free to ask any other questions.
No, go ahead. I'm surprised you managed to hold back this long.
I'm down a very deep rabbit hole of AI and running AI locally as well, especially in AI models, stuff like that. Just off topic or maybe even not from a business sense, how do you think AI is going to affect even MySudo and privacy in general?
Yeah, so it's with any new technology, there's the good and the bad. So the good side of it, so do we use AI? And the answer is yes, and I'll tell you where. We've used it in one product so far. So we have a product called Reclaim. And what Reclaim does is it asks for you to point Reclaim at your Gmail inbox. And the idea is it walks through the whole inbox, and then it comes up with a report and says, here's all the accounts you've got. And for each one of them, it says, do you want to action it? And the action is, I want to go and delete that account. We show you how to go and delete that account. Or it might say, how about you swap the details with my pseudo details? If you want to keep it going, get your personal details out there and swap them for my pseudo details. So we use some AI in that Reclaim product, and it's good, and we'll use more. We're looking at how to use AI within MySudo to help you use your pseudos better and make that more effective. The hard thing about using pseudos, as I said, is you're building the muscle, but sometimes you get kind of persona regret, where you've used the wrong persona in the wrong situation, and then afterwards you go, oh, I've just given something away here because I've just used, you know, the wrong persona in the wrong circumstance. And you can do that. So we want to look at using AI with MySudo to help you when you're online. You go and create an account, and you go, okay, we suggest you should use this pseudo. This is your travel pseudo that you've used on the other travel site. Why don't you use that here as well? So we want to use it for a good purpose, right? So, but I would say in general, AI is going to be terrible for privacy, because, you know, if you think about what Google's doing and all the data brokers, they want to find out all these bits of things that you're doing all over the place and correlate them together, have a good story about you, and be able to sell that off to people about why they should pay for that information. AI is going to make that much, much worse, because it's going to be able to find – it'll be interesting to see whether it, you know, it breaks the persona model, whether it can – through its thing, work out that this person with five personas is actually the same person. So I don't know, but I sort of suspect that these models will be able to find things that normal humans wouldn't be able to spot.
I've actually been thinking, it's funny she even mentioned persona regret. Like the other day I gave the wrong masked email to a service.
Yep.
And I sort of got down on myself, oh, what an idiot. And then I was thinking, I'm like 99.99% ahead of everyone else. Like I don't know why I'm stressing so much about one little mistake. So yeah, don't stress if you make a little mistake like
that. Yeah, and that's why you build that muscle up. So we are looking, we're thinking about ways to use AI to help using personas. Mm-hmm. So for example, you know, I said we've got these browser extensions. So we've got like a browser extension. So when you go to create a new account, all your pseudo information is available there, so you can easily get access to the email address and the phone number and things like that when you go and create that account. That's again to try to make it easier so that somebody doesn't have to have their mobile here and be copying stuff across. You can just access it within an extension when you're form filling. But again, you can easily pick the wrong one and you go, oh, I've just used the wrong one then. And that's where I think AI might be able to help, because it could look and go, well, I'm actually looking at this website and experience sort of says that you're using the wrong persona there, or last time you were at that website using this information, now using this information, and try to block some of those things. So I think AI can be used for good. And as I said, we're already using it in the Reclaim product, but I think overall it can be used for a lot of bad stuff as well, as we know, we know.
There's going to be so many things, like we all use, master email and whatnot. And to the human, you've used separate email addresses and the gobbledygook or random, whatever, however you structure that. But to an AI, it might be like, well, he sends an email this particular timestamp and he uses this. Yep. There'll be patterns that the AI can pick up that we just don't. We think we're fully humans, but we're not going to be able to fully.
Yeah, and so what we've been looking at is also the communication side of things. So you go and write an email from a pseudo male email address, or you send a text message, or even if you're talking, leaving a message, right, they really need to go through sort of a filter that's kind of mapping it to a different style. So each of your personas should have different writing styles and different voice styles so that they can't be mapped together, because otherwise it'll all come back to Paul. Like, okay, look, we've seen this email and this email, and the AI will know they're the same person, right? Like, so then you go, well, I need to use the AI now to take my email, restructure it, and send it out in a different style. It's like
maybe the AI could randomize my writing style. So I send a message to Ferris in the morning with a really informal style, and then the afternoon, a drunken rant, and then in the evening, something else,
I know. So these are all the new complexities that we're going to have to deal with. But I think that's true with all cybersecurity as well. Like privacy and cybersecurity, it's always, it's the attack and then the prevention, and the attack and the prevention, and you're trying to always stay ahead of it.
And again, I mean, anyone listening to this is probably vastly ahead of most other people. And as we said, if you at least master your email addresses and don't use a password manager, you're ahead of 99% of other people. So
I agree. I totally agree.
Are you into Bitcoin, Lightning, Nosta, decentralized identity, or is that not?
I'm getting distracted. I'm fully into decentralized identity, and I would say in the Web3, because it's kind of a Web3 technology in that a lot of the decentralized identity is backed by ledgers and blockchains, etc. Am I every day working in the Web3 space? I would say not. I'd say I'm not a Web3 expert. Obviously, I know a fair bit about blockchains and ledgers and coins and all those kind of things, but I wouldn't say Anonymy is a Web3 company. What I would say is, when we're doing work with decentralized identity, let's say we're backed with, there's one of the networks is called Checked, and that's a full, open ledger system that we use. So we're using the technology, but it's kind of for the identity's sake, not for the Web3 sake, if it makes sense. So I would say we're not Web3 experts, but know a reasonable amount about it.
So no MySudo token coming out on the horizon?
It is funny. I can remember around the heady days when tokens first got released, and there was a time where we were going to release a pseudo token, and we decided not to. And then most of the people that released tokens that year, I think, ended up in jail. Mm-hmm. There was a time when we did talk about it. So no, we have not ever released a token. But when you use the Checked network, so that's CHEQD, that's one of the ledgers backing decentralized identity. There's a Checked token on there. You can use it to pay verifiable credentials. You use it when you want to write to the network and all that. And so we are involved with technology that does have all those capabilities. But for us, we're kind of a we're trying to do a decentralized identity system that happens to be backed by that versus that's not our main concern. It's just like, it's what we call the VDR, the Verifiable Data Registry, and that's where we put public keys and DIDs and all these sort of things on there. So we're using that technology, but we're not specifically, I'd say, a Web3-focused company.
Could just say you're still peer-to-peer without a blockchain.
Correct, yeah.
Okay. Back in the day, I was talking to Faris about Bitcoin in 2017, 2018, was all, you know, all this tokenized and whatever took off. I created a 5-page PDF. I'm really glad that I didn't launch anything because, yeah, I'd probably be in jail and have all kinds of lawsuits. But, yeah, like people literally, you know, they were raising millions of dollars on a PDF file. It was insane.
Yeah, it was insane. And a lot of those people, I can remember a lot of them like a year or two later were starting to get in trouble with the SEC and that because they're like, you know, if you're going to sell something, then you need to give some part of your company. Like when you sell shares, it's because they're taking some ownership of the company. So, you're getting something for your money. If you go and buy a token, and the question was to the SEC is what are you actually getting there? And so, it was a heady year around that 2017, whatever, where they all were getting released. And we got close to doing it, but then we decided not to. And then, it wasn't long before they all started getting chased down and by the regulators, especially in the US.
Yes.
They say that authenticity is the best currency.
Authenticity is the best currency.
Yeah, we got almost sucked into 2017, all the white page, because I remember seeing that, and that was just terrifying because that was when I was first getting into the whole Bitcoin space. And
Yeah,
I mean, Doge, perfect example, literally started as a joke. And then Elon Musk tweets about it, and next thing you know, it's like, oh.
Yeah. But it's I'm a big believer in that space in terms of if the network's useful and the coin is useful, the coin will go up in value. The Ethereums, the Bitcoins and the Czech network and things like that, where there's a utility to it, I think, there's value there, but there's a lot, there's a lot of noise there as well. There's a lot of noise where there's a lot of stuff that's not valuable.
Yeah, not called shitcoins for a reason.
Yes.
We could get you back to talk about zero knowledge proofs, decentralized identity.
Yep.
I could talk to you on a separate podcast that no one would listen to about programming in C. I did my internship at IBM as well, so that's kind of interesting. Yeah. Is there anything? We'll wrap it up. We're coming up to an hour, so I really appreciate your time, Paul. Is there anything you'd like to plug or anything that we haven't asked you?
No, I actually think that for the listeners out there is do take privacy seriously, do take it seriously and start the journey. And maybe you start with a VPN solution and you get used to using that across your mobiles and across your home and different things like that. Then go to the next level, go to a password manager, start to manage your accounts that way. And then you can start to think about things like MySudo and you go to that, let's have different identity data. So I think it's a journey. So I always just think everyone needs to do this. And I always talk to people all the time about this. Everyone has to lift their game in this space. Otherwise you're just going to end up as a victim. Something terrible is going to happen to you in a financial way. And it's because somebody's got a whole lot of private information for you. So I guess I could leave this just to saying, I recommend everyone take the privacy journey and start to learn and listen to podcasts and do all those things and just get better and better over time.
Good advice. I think we'll leave it at that. And thank you once again for being our very first guest. So
thanks, Gordon.
Yeah, maybe episode 100, we'll have you back on.
You just let me know.
Thanks again, Paul.
Yeah, no problem at all. Yeah, if you want to talk again or whatever, no problem. Yeah, I'm always available here.
And final plug, we'll put all the links to what we talked about in the description. But for audio listeners, where should they be?
Oh, in terms of just understanding what we do at Anonymy, for example, you just go to the Anonymy Labs website if you have a look at that. And if that talks about everything, what we call our B2C solutions, which is Reclaim and MySudo and the VPN and everything. And then it talks about our platform, which is more for the B2B and what we do there. So all of that's available on our website.
Great. Thanks, Paul.
Thanks, Gordon. Thanks, Faris.
Thank you.
Thanks for watching or listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, please like, subscribe, and share so we can spread this educational content to others like yourself.